Hi, this is Chuck Marone with Strong Towns. This week is our membership drive. And unlike a lot of traditional business models, we have kind of a strange approach here. We don't tend to chase around foundations begging them for money. We don't have a lot of big money people who have signed up to give us dollars. Most of the revenue that we have comes from two sources. It comes from me spending a ton of time out on the road, meeting with communities and having them make donations to our organization as part of that effort. And then from you, the members. We rely on you to help us fund this program, to help us fund this podcast, to help us fund the blog and the other things that we're doing. And one of the things we've realized is that the more support that we can get from you, the less time, not only that I have to spend out on the road, but the more time that I can spend actually producing content and coming up with the stuff that you guys have all said you want to see and hear from us. So I'm asking you to take a few moments, go to our site, strongtowns.org, and click on Become a Member. Our basic membership is $25 a year. We have advocate members that are $75 a year and on up from there. Please do what you can and help us to help you continue to build a nation full of strong towns. You're listening to the Strong Towns Podcast. Hey, this is Chuck Marone with Strong Towns back at CNU 22 in Buffalo. I have with me from the United Kingdom, Ben Hamilton Bailey. Ben is an urban designer from Bristol, flew in yesterday, right? A little bit of jet lag, baby. He's going to be giving the plenary this Friday morning and wanted to chat with him because I love the topic of shared space, transportation, and I'm very fascinated by the fact that he calls himself a recovering architect. So Ben, welcome to the Strong Towns Podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about shared space. Okay. And I'd like to hear, because over here we're fascinated with it in certain circles, and in certain circles it seems like a ridiculous notion. Mm. But where you come from, it's actually advanced quite a bit. And I'd like to just hear how you would, in your words, describe the concept. Mm.
Well, it's worth going back to a little bit of history here, in that a couple of decades ago, I was working with an organization called Sustrans, building the project called the National Cycle Network in the UK. And part of that project involved understanding traffic engineering and the design of streets, because we wanted a completely connected network of safe routes. And in doing so, I began to be puzzled by the background history and principles and philosophy of traffic engineering. Where did this profession come from, and why did it fit so uneasily with the rest of the design world? I was lucky enough to get a traveling fellowship to go and explore traffic in towns in a number of European countries, mainland European countries. So I spent a happy 10 weeks touring Germany and Switzerland and Sweden and Denmark and the Netherlands, trying to find and talk to the people at the leading edge of thinking about safety and congestion and traffic in towns and pedestrian movement and so forth. And I was very lucky. I was met Jan Giel in Copenhagen, of course, but he put me in touch with two people, a man called Joost Waal, who was an engineer from Hungary, but working in the Netherlands, who was really the founder of what we now call the VONERF, who was the first person in the 70s to begin to design residential streets, which were mixed multi-purpose spaces, which included vehicles, but on a different concept to our conventional street design. And he was very interesting. He said to me, you know, things like, the only way, Ben, you ever make a street safe is you must make it dangerous. And I thought, that's an interesting paradox to begin with. But he also suggested that he put me in touch with a man called Hans Mondermann. And I'd never heard of Hans Mondermann before. And so
last year I made Hans Mondermann t-shirts and handed them out. So I keep going. I'm fascinated.
Well, that was a very lucky break, because Hans, I rang him up and he answered the phone first time and said, fine, I'll get, you know, let's spend a day together. I met this, to my surprise, besuited, very sober-looking, avuncular civil servant from the north of the Netherlands who was head of road safety in the province of the Netherlands. And Hans very generously gave me his time and showed me his work, and I was completely bowled away. He was a traffic engineer who had completely rethought the principles of traffic in towns and not only come up with observations about human behavior, which were very interesting, but had put them into practice. There was, you know, no doubting the stuff worked. They were all over his native Friesland. There were towns and villages and bigger cities that had started to adopt his notion of removing conventional traffic signals and road markings and signs and separation and barriers and all of those things, and started to work with a much, much richer understanding of human psychology. It's no coincidence that Hans, as you probably know, was, in addition to being a very senior civil servant and a civil engineer and a traffic engineer, was also a driving instructor.
I did not know that.
He ran an advanced driving school. He was a very hardworking man. And being a driving instructor gave him an insight into how drivers respond to the cues around them. And that, I think, informed a combination of very good engineering skills with psychology, gave him this extraordinary take on how to handle traffic in towns. But Hans was difficult to pigeonhole. He was a great car enthusiast. He loved cars. He thought they were a very brilliant bit of technology. And he had no time with the sort of left sandal-wearing hippies who wanted to rid towns of cars.
Right.
He was a useful bit of kit. But he realized that if you wanted to create safety, as he said, first of all, never ever treat drivers as idiots because you get idiotic behavior. Treat drivers as intelligent beings and you get an intelligent response. And we know that from educational psychology. It's just the same in traffic engineering.
The quote from him that I actually put on the shirt, because I made a line of t-shirts last year of Hans Mondermann, and it was, when you treat people like idiots, they act like idiots. And that's a brilliant insight that I think traffic engineers assume everybody's an idiot.
He first demonstrated that to me when the first hour that we met him, we drove out on a very hot July day through the very bucolic pastoral Friesland landscape. It's lovely, a very lot of cows, it's very rural, and he was driving me down a little tiny country lane with cows on either side, and I kind of thought, I'm not sure I'm in the right place. I was studying traffic in towns. What am I doing out here?
Right.
He stopped the car. He said, "Did you see that sign back there?" So I said, "No." So he said, "You might have a look and tell me what it means." And it was a standard European triangular warning sign, standard across all of Europe, with a cow in the middle. So he said, "Now, what does that mean?" And I said, "Well, I guess it means beware of cows."
Yeah.
And he said, "Now, look, you can see them, you can hear them, you can smell them, you can just about reach out your hands and touch them. You'd have to be completely sensorily deprived not to know there are cows around here."
Right.
"And you're not allowed to drive a car if you're sensorily deprived."
Right.
"That sign says, you're a friggin' idiot, and we don't trust you."
Yeah.
"Now, first rule, never do that to drivers. Right. Never, ever treat them as idiots. Use their common sense in just the same way that if you walk into a church, you don't need a sign saying, do not fart."
Right.
Everybody knows that there's a social protocols that we are very powerful if we just let them be and don't talk about them too much.
Right.
For that moment, I thought, this is an interesting man. Here's an interesting traffic engineer.
Right. Because usually the traffic engineers are out there erecting the signs.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But Hans and I then started quite a long and for me, very happy partnership. I then went over to the States for a year at Harvard with notes and thoughts and was able to process that. And we still had no terminology to describe. It wasn't just Hans Mondermann. I mean, you know, Bjarne Vinterberg in Denmark was doing pretty much the same thing. There were people in Spain, in Switzerland, a remarkable engineer called Fritz Kobe was doing fascinating stuff in Bern in Switzerland to introduce low-speed, continuous flow movement patterns. But we didn't have a term for it. The Von Erf meant something else. People were saying this is a bit Mondermannish, and that wasn't a very good term.
Right.
You know, traffic calming wasn't right. We needed a term. Hans and I decided to put a bid in for European Union funding for a big research project, and it needed a title. So he and I spent a long evening on the telephone, and I then sat with a bottle of whiskey most of the night, and by next morning we had the term shared space.
Yeah.
And it just seemed the closest we could get to what we were talking about. He said, that's fine, that'll do.
Yeah.
And it stuck.
Yeah.
So the term shared space merely described a much bigger shift in the spectrum, if you like, away from the regulated world of the state deciding what you do, traffic signals, highway rules, speed limits, speed cameras, all of that stuff, towards the social protocols and informal negotiations that govern us in the rest of our lives. I don't need to be told where to sit or how to deal with you as another individual, because we have very powerful social protocols that determine how we behave. And what Hans was saying, if you allow those to be at the forefront, there'll be more effective determinants of safe behavioral techniques and therefore safety and traffic in towns than is the state.
You know, when I heard Hans Monnermann describe this in videos, when I've listened to your work, there's something very like human about this.
Sure.
That seems like we should very easily grasp it and almost say, this is the most logical thing. Yet I see and hear people, when you suggest this, completely freak out and want the what I would call like the nanny state, the, you know, the large top-down regulation.
Well, to jump forward a few years, we worked on a flagship scheme in London called Exhibition Road. Exhibition Road is an unusual street. It connects all the great cultural center museums and, you know, the Goethe Institute and the École Française and the Ismaili Center and blah, blah, blah. A wonderful set of expensive and valuable buildings, but the street itself was miserable. Under very strong political leadership in the borough of Kensington Chelsea, I was lucky enough to be part of the team to rethink this space. And just before the proposals were launched, there was a concern from the Department for Transport, the government, about how are they going to sign this street? I mean, this is a street without rules, without signs, without crossings, without traffic. You know, not Times of London, the Times journalists picked up on this and produced a cartoon with a driver driving along and a road sign which said, do anything you like ahead.
Okay.
Which kind of pinned it on the head. In other words, the responsibility is on you as a human being to make decisions, not to allow the state to decide through a red light or a green light or whatever it is to determine what your movements were. Mm-hmm. And I think this chimes with a much bigger shift away from the optimism of the 50s and sort of post-end of the 20th century, when really both the left and the right wing of political philosophy assumed that somehow the state could take care of you from cradle to grave.
Right.
That could, as long as the rules were strong enough, we could sort out social problems.
We could optimize it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see that reflected in everything from Le Corbusier's writing about ordered streets, you know, would live over here and work over here and play over here.
Right.
To the paintings of Mondrian, very ordered, calm, clear, rational order. And what we've learned recently is, of course, that life is much, much more complicated than that.
Right.
And the more we learn about the human brain and the genome project and DNA and human psychology, we've made great strides in the past 20 years. We realize that the human brain is completely fantastic. And we are so good and quick at responding to stimuli into different environments and to circumstances that actually you don't need the state to tell you how to behave or what to do. You don't need a sign saying, beware of cows. It's perfectly obvious where the cows are. And that's the reason that I'll use the image of the ice skating rink.
Okay.
Because ice skating rinks are fascinating because a whole bunch of strangers come together on sliding around on steel blades.
And at high speeds, right?
How are you going to sort these people out so they don't bump into each
other? Some are falling, some
are
really good.
Some are experts, some are beginners. You know, and you couldn't model that process. But we all know that who've ever had the joy of ice skating is that part of the pleasure comes from this incredible coordination and anticipation that you enter into with a whole bunch of strangers. Mm-hmm. But in ways that remind us of flocks of birds sometimes or shells of fish in the way that we move. And so that we've got skills in negotiating movement and giving way or priority or taking precedence, which are much more complex than saying, First, it's the traffic stop, then it's the pedestrian stop, or the cyclists are here, and the wheelchairs are here, or something like that. Life is more complicated than that.
How do you see the engineering profession adapting or not adapting to some of this new, I won't even call it new thinking, but new awareness of the complexity of cities and places and these environments?
Well, I'm quite optimistic, really. Progress has been faster than certainly Hans predicted before he died. He said I would spend 30 years getting to really integrate this into the professions, the engineering professions. Of course, it's frustrating, but I'm encouraged by the UK government produced a document 3 or 4 years ago now called the Manual for Streets. Now, you can file this under dull but important.
Right.
Because it wasn't the world's most thrilling document to read, but it was immensely important. It has influenced particularly the UK by introducing the notion that streets were places in their own right as well as corridors for movement. Now, that's something that most of us take for granted. Of course they are. That's what cities are about. But up until that moment, there wasn't a policy basis to talk to engineers about placemaking. It wasn't in their language and lexicon. Ever since Manual for Streets, it is. And that slowly we're getting a generation of engineers, traffic engineers. I mean, I would cite two, Ian Lockwood in the States or Phil Jones in the UK, who get the notion of placemaking and the psychology of behavior built into streets in ways that doesn't just rely on, you know, turning to the right page in the traffic manual. And remember that the previous policy statement was 1966, Roads in Urban Areas, which is based on the Buchanan Report, which said the only way to deal with traffic in towns is to segregate traffic at all opportunities from pedestrian movement. So you must have underpasses or overbridges or barriers or high curbs or pedestrian areas. You mustn't mix traffic and pedestrians. And that seemed a very logical notion
at the time.
But that hadn't actually come into the political policy making until Manual for Streets. So the engineering profession slowly, of course, it varies between municipalities, but you are seeing younger engineers beginning to realize that, my golly, we are being empowered to think for ourselves. You don't have to follow a rule book.
That's the thing I find fascinating.
There's no dragon in the filing cabinet that's going to bite us in the bum if we do something wrong, because the dragon doesn't exist.
Right. I'm actually can engineer.
Yeah. And I mean, lots of engineers say, well, we couldn't do this because we'd be sued.
Right.
And to which a lot of people, including the Institution of Civil Engineers, says, nonsense.
Right.
Absolute nonsense.
Totally.
You can only be sued if you're negligent. Mm-hmm. And you're not negligent if you've demonstrated that you've thought about a problem and come up with a solution.
Right.
Something may go wrong. Life is complicated.
Right.
But as long as you've demonstrated that you've thought about it professionally, taken good advice, and investigated it with a modicum of professional thoroughness, you're not negligent.
It's fascinating because even here in the U.S., where we're, you know, litigation happy, I see that same exact thing. I mean, we get engineers all the time who say, well, there's too much liability in doing that. And we will actually contact the city's insurance company and say, what do you think about this? And they say, well, do you have a policy? Have you actually like looked at alternatives? Mm-hmm. And then you chose this one. That's all you need to do.
Sure.
You can't design a system that has zero accident rate. No. You can't design a system that will work 100% of the time.
No.
But as long as you are rational about how you go about it and thoughtful, we don't have a problem insuring you.
Sure. Having the Institution of Civil Engineers publish a book called Highway Risk and Liability, poorly presented and poorly circulated, but nevertheless very clear that it was not either professionally respectable or indeed wise for engineers merely to repeat what they've always done. You know, why did the engineer cross the road? Because that's what we did last year.
Exactly.
You know, in other words, freeing up engineers to think and to use a multitude of understandings and skills, as Hans Mondermann did, and not merely, well, I've been trained that, you know, page 56 of some manual says
that's
X.
Why you go into engineering in the first place, right? Because you're a thoughtful problem solver.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We were fortunate in having a decision by the House of Lords, dear old House of Lords. I know people laugh at this old bunch.
In America, we love, I mean, the House of Lords just seems such like a wonderful institution.
They're a wonderful anachronism, but they do come up with occasionally some very wise decisions and they're ultimate court, you know, the highest court in the land. And a case called Gorringe versus Calderdale, strange name, Mrs. Gorringe, but she clarified things very well. She, a native of Calderdale, and was driving home on a road she was familiar with, but the local authority, Calderdale, had taken out all the road markings and warning signs on a bend in the road, and she drove too fast around the corner and rolled her car and was injured. And her insurance company sued the local authority for not putting warning signs on that on the bend. And amazingly, the case went to the House of Lords, who ruled unanimously and very forcefully in favour of the local authority and granted them all costs, arguing that it is not the duty of the state to protect the driver from his or her foolish actions, and that therefore a local authority may choose to put up a warning sign, but there's no obligation to. You mustn't entrap drivers, but you cannot protect drivers from their own foolishness, and they shouldn't try to. And at a time when local authority budgets are under pressure, it's become very important to be clear about what your statutory relationship with your public is, and that there's no need to put up a warning sign that may in its turn facilitate somebody to drive fast.
Right.
Why do you want to do that?
I was in Kansas City a couple of years ago, and in our organization, this has become kind of a famous thing in our circle of listeners, because when I was there, they have a little bit like Buffalo here, these really wide streets with no traffic.
Yeah.
And, stores that are kind of dying along it and, land use that's really struggling. And I came up with a list of suggestions to them. And one of them was get rid of your traffic signals, which are the only source of congestion you have, and develop your downtown into a shared space environment. I was roundly attacked and criticized by people from Kansas City, both engineers and non-engineers and place advocates. And
why?
Oh, because that's a crazy idea. People will kill themselves. There'll be mayhem and chaos. It was a little bit of a, kind of, I think, not understanding the concept well, and I didn't explain it deeply enough in the suggestion.
Well, it is very, very counterintuitive. I mean,
it is.
I come back to this statement, the only way to make a street safe is make it dangerous.
Right.
That risk compensation theory, which is a boring name for an extremely important foundation stone for shared space. You can't really understand shared space before you realize that life is complicated, that risks, hazards, are useful ways of keeping us safe. And you don't create safety by preventing access to hazards, because we adjust our behavior to the level of risk with which we're comfortable. So that a pedestrian guardrail or a warning sign or a seat belt or an ABS, an auto braking system on a car, doesn't necessarily keep us safer. It adjusts our behavior and transfers the risk somewhere else. That's quite a complicated issue to understand, so that the notion that most accidents are good things, which is a very important principle.
Right.
If you're bringing up a toddler, that toddler has to burn his or her finger on a fire once or twice to become safe in the event of fire.
Right.
You don't make that toddler safe by never exposing him or her to fire. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, I have teenagers learning to drive. I want them to have accidents.
Right.
I hope they survive them.
Right.
But I want them to have the learning process.
I remember as my first, 6 months with a car, I went in the ditch twice.
Absolutely.
And I learned navigating the corners to how to drive a lot safer. And it was one of those things where I had a $350 car. I crashed into a couple of trees and learned some lessons, but learned them kind of inexpensively.
But coming back to the Kansas City example, the difficulty is that if you take any one of these elements in isolation, like taking out traffic signals or taking out barriers or something, it's unlikely to work in isolation.
Right.
Because the whole of shared space is premised around lower design speeds. Mm-hmm. And I say design speeds in contrast to speed limits, because they're quite different things. That shared space works when you can foster and facilitate traffic to move smoothly and continuously at a speed which is compatible with human behavior. And we have evolved to cope with the speeds of up to 18, 19, 20, 21 miles an hour. It's the speed of a fit young hunter chasing an antelope. Our skull thickness, our rib cage is all premised around that speed. and we can anticipate and move within that speed framework pretty well. Move above that speed and you feel very uncomfortable, you can't do it, and are, you know, for all sorts of reasons, we're less comfortable. So the question is, how do you then introduce a speed framework, a speed context, which is compatible with shared space? And the answer isn't speed limits or speed cameras or speed bumps or chicanes or all those barriers. It is about giving the driver sufficient cues that encourage that to happen naturally. So concepts like edge friction, which is a new concept in engineering, that you must fill the driver's peripheral vision with as much activity and interest, ambiguity, intrigue, uncertainty, the things that conventional engineering hates dealing with.
It tries to get rid of at all costs, right?
Well, what you want is a bit of uncertainty,
right,
because that makes the brain slow down to absorb lots of cues, and without thinking about it, you're driving slower. So you want lots of beautiful women on the streets, you want to have lots of cafes, you want to have flowers, you want to have life happening in the edge peripheral vision, and speeds will drop. Now, again, that means engineers designing their streets outside the highway boundaries, because what happens on the buildings, what happens, how close the trees are to the edge, what the shape of the canopy, the lighting, the materials, and so on, will all combine to engender a speed context.
Right.
And the question is merely, what is the preferred speed context? If you're designing a freeway, you want traffic to be moving at 60 miles an hour or something, whatever it is. And so you keep the edges free of any incident. There's nothing to distract your peripheral vision. So you drive fast.
Right.
There are big signs which confirm your view that that's the speed you should be driving at. But in a town, you want the opposite. If you want lower speeds, you want small things that you really have to look, use your eyes and use your brain to look at. And you want unexpected incident and crazy public art or people hanging up an unusual sign which you remember, or an old friend, haven't seen him for a while.
Right.
And that all helps to bring speeds down. So at Poynton,
I was going to ask you about Poynton.
Well,
because it's a beautiful example. The YouTube video is fantastic, and we've showed it to dozens of audiences over here. And there's something intuitive, you know, when you watch it from the way it was to the way it is, there's something calming even watching it, you know, that you experience as a person. Can you describe that?
Sure. I mean, it wasn't an easy scheme. Poynton is a very ordinary place, which is why I like it. It's not a big city center. It's south of Manchester. It's an ordinary workaday retail town of about 16,000 people. And it's a crossroads town. Mm-hmm. Over the years, the traffic volumes have built up to a huge volume, 26,000 vehicles. There's no bypass, and nor was there any prospect for one. This town, as a result, was dying. The little high street, or main street as you would call it, running off the one side of the junction, had 16 out of its 32 businesses boarded up and closed, and no sign of any further investment. So big decisions had to be made if Poynton was to be saved. So we had the political momentum to do something. But it became pretty clear to us that you could pave that high street, that shopping street, with gold, it wouldn't have made any difference, as long as it was cut off from the rest of its town by this desperate junction with traffic signals and turning lanes and more turning lanes and more warning signs. And, you know,
it was horrible.
It was horrible.
It was really, really bad.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
And nobody nowadays chooses to come into town if it's horrible. I mean, you can get your stuff on the internet or out of town superstores, go there. You wouldn't go to the local store.
Right.
You had to make it a place where people would choose voluntarily to come in to spend time in Poynton. So that meant we had to really get rid of not the traffic, because we couldn't get rid of the traffic, but we wanted to get rid of the paraphernalia that had been put in place to cope with the traffic.
Right.
So we proposed taking out the traffic signals, taking out the road markings, reducing the lanes of traffic from 3 to 1 in each of the approaches to the junction. Now, many engineers thought we were
insane.
Cooking land.
Right. No, that's crazy.
We've got 1 mile congested queues with 3 lanes, and you're proposing to reduce them to 1 lane? You've got to be crazy.
Right.
But we argued that your speed of journey in a town, a city, it doesn't matter where it is, has nothing to do with your speed between the nodes, between points. You can drive at 1,000 miles an hour between the stoplights. You don't make it get you anywhere there faster. Your speed is determined by the efficiency of the junction. And junctions work much more efficiently at low speeds, at around about 12, 13, 14 miles, very tight headways, mm-hmm. junction, people can negotiate very easily. They also work better with a single entry, line of traffic entry, because then the driver is not overloaded.
Yeah.
They can make the cognitive decisions to keep flowing, and you see, as it works now, the traffic very rarely pauses. You get constant movement. The junctions in working very hard to keep the traffic moving. It did require some very bold political decisions because it wasn't popular. It was very counterintuitive. Taking the lights out with 26,000 vehicles a day and no rules. And interestingly, the debate about speed limits, because there was a 30-mile-an-hour speed limit, as there is in all built-up areas. And nowadays, you can introduce a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit. And a lot of people, understandably, said, well, surely you'll introduce a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit, won't you? And I argued against it. I don't think it's necessary. I mean, I wasn't going to die in a ditch over the issue. I don't care, really. But I said, it's not important. It's really not an important issue.
People will just drive.
People will drive to the cues that they get from the road. They're nothing to do with the speed limit. Right. But in hindsight, I'm now very glad we won that argument, because I think that placing a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit would have set up exactly the wrong expectations in the driver's mind. The state is telling me how fast I can drive, and I should be going 20 miles an hour. Actually, no. If there's school children are coming out and crossing the road, you should be driving at 10,
right.
12.
Right.
If grandma wants to cross the road, it's a different speed. Mm-hmm. If a fire engine's coming, you know, it's different. Mm-hmm. You're taking your cues from your surroundings, not from the state. So the debate about speed limits, I think, was a helpful one. And we, in fact, won the argument, and it's still 30 miles an hour to this day, although nobody drives through Boynton at 30 miles an hour.
Right.
It meant that a politician, a local politician, had to take a very bold set of decisions, realizing that this was about the future of the town, the existence of Boynton. And whilst engineers are arguing about whether there'll be congestion or not and how pedestrians would cross and whether it would be safe and blah, 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 he kept saying, that's all very well, but actually the purpose is about the town. And if it's congested or not, I don't really care. Mm-hmm. And this is important because transport is right. often seen, and transportation has developed in the past, as almost like an end in itself, a right. goal in its own right. And it isn't. It's merely a means to an end. It's a means to service and support our communities, our cities. Mm. And cities are only about two things. They're about economic exchange or social exchange. Mm. That's all we use it for. Money, sex. Right. That's all.
You know, sure.
Basically. you know, the purpose of towns is not to move between them. It's useful. We need to move between them. We need right. transportation.
Right.
But that's not the purpose. And Howard Murray, who was the politician for Boynton, had to keep reminding people that this wasn't a transportation project. It was an economic project.
Right.
If drivers grumbled that they didn't find it comfortable, well, good. That's great, you know. Or if people find it's, I don't know what the rules are. I feel terrible. Oh, it's good. Great. Okay, that's what we're not. So it's difficult because, I mean, my mailbag is full of people saying, I don't like Boynton. I drove through it. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And I write back and say, that's great.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
We succeeded, yeah.
But the nice thing is to see the economic recovery of Boynton so dramatic.
Yeah, but it looks like it's been huge.
Last year, it was voted the 7th most popular place in the UK to live.
Wow.
The footfall has increased about fourfold. People, the dwell time, more importantly than the footfall, people, the amount of time that people spend in the town having coffee with their mates or shopping. Of course, the nature of the shops are otherwise ones which you can't get on the internet. You can get your nails done or you have a cup of coffee or
right.
a specialist hardware shop where you get good advice and you know who you're dealing with and so on. So towns are having to change very rapidly.
Right.
And the Boynton operation, you know, it was major open heart surgery, as it were, helped that transformation so that now you've got the sort of shops that people want to come into town for anyway, all the businesses and the cafes and the life, you know, it's interesting.
Right.
And the town has changed.
Let me ask you about congestion, though. From what I've seen at Boynton, and there was the one set of videos about when the lights went out in London and they interviewed
the
people.
Flow, yeah.
This actually, traffic congestion is not the problem when you're done with this.
Traffic congestion is not the problem. I was recently in Toronto and I asked them, the city, you know, what are the big issues here? And they said, traffic congestion. And I said, well, I have bad news for you. Every successful city there's ever been has been congested. Yeah. The time to start worrying is when you haven't got traffic congestion. Right. That's when you should be really scared.
Buffalo has no traffic congestion.
Detroit, that's when you start worrying.
Right.
Traffic congestion in London has remained pretty constant since 1890 to 2014. Mm-hmm. Traffic speed of movement is between 9 and 11 miles an hour, which it was in Sherlock Holmes's mythical time to today. That's the capacity that the street network has. And if you drive a Ferrari, a Maserati, or a Hanson Horsen cab, you make the same speed.
Yeah.
Martial Echenik, who's the head of a professor of architecture at Cambridge University, wrote a seminal paper in the 1970s. The solution to traffic congestion is to do nothing. Whatever you do, it'll still be congested.
Right.
So don't worry about traffic congestion. And that's very hard to say because people's perception is it takes me hours to commute or to get through. I'm being a little bit flippant here because...
You're speaking my language.
Okay. So. but I mean, in Poynton, we did measure the journey times, mm-hmm. and it was badly congested before with the traffic signals, and it was taking about, well, depend on time of day, but 20, 25 minutes to get through this little town. Mm-hmm. And by removing the lights, removing the traffic lanes, thinning down the carriageways to very narrow 3-meter lanes, we've reduced the journey times by more than 50%. I mean, it takes us half the amount of time to get through. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, I can't see where we've lost because we've managed to create a huge amount of additional space, which we've been able to give to temporary car parking or wider footways, pavements, sidewalks, to trading places that shops can spill out and trade on the front. Enormous amounts of space. There's a wonderful church on the crossroads in Poynton designed by Alfred Waterhouse, our greatest Victorian architect. And it's very popular with weddings and funerals and so on. Weddings, they're booked up 2 years ahead. I don't know how people book up their weddings 2 years ahead, but they do.
Wow.
But previously, there's a beautiful lych gate on the edge of the entry to the church. And this opened out onto this ghastly kind of traffic signal controlled hell.
Right.
And again, I'd go up there on a Saturday and you see some bride trying to make a dignified entrance to the church.
Yeah.
Getting out with a, you know, huge truck right up the back of the bridal car traffic signals going and fumes and noise. And you know, I used to speak to the photographers, the wedding photographers, and they say, this is the worst gig in the world. You cannot get a good shot of the bride and her father, you know, entering the church. And I thought, this is crazy.
Right. I mean, we live here.
What's the point of having a town and a church and if you can't do this? So we've been able to create very generous space outside the church.
Yeah.
And a lot of people said, how are you going to stop people parking on there? So it's obvious that that's where the hearse or the bridal car waits. It's obvious it has. It's a church. You can see.
Who's going to park right in front of the church?
Let people be intelligent. Yeah. And if somebody misbehaves, somebody will soon frown at them and tell them off. They'll feel uncomfortable. You
know. Last question. This has been fascinating. I love this stuff. I'm a little bit depressed because I feel like you're doing amazing work. There's other people doing amazing work, but it's on the other side of the ocean. How much hope is there for us here in the United States? Do you have any optimism for us that this is going to become – maybe it's Hans's time frame, the next 30 years.
Well,
is there a time frame where this becomes part of America?
No, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic because change in these fields can happen very fast. Mm-hmm. Just note how quickly we've changed our habits on smoking, for example. Phenomenal speed. Clearly, the context on this side of the Atlantic is different, and you're dealing with a built environment which tends to post-date the introduction of the automobile on the whole, mm-hmm. with a few exceptions.
Right.
And so that the scale is bigger, the streets are wider, the buildings are bigger, you know, and the sprawl is greater and so forth. But that, I think, merely means that your placemaking techniques have to work a little harder, be a bit tougher. The principles are just the same. Human beings are just the same, whether you live in Manhattan or the, you know, the jungles of South America. People are the same. A smile, a gesture, a beautiful woman turning the heads of men. It's exactly the same everywhere you go.
Right.
And all that shared space is about is using who we are as a human species, a complex primate, a great ape, who likes living socially. We like congregating in places. We're very technically proficient. We've got wonderful machines to help us around. But if you work with the understanding the psychology of who we are and how our evolution has shaped us, then that's the same in the States or Canada or Italy or China or India or anywhere else. We're the same species. And that's why I think I'm optimistic, because America, more than anywhere else, has the ability to reinvent itself very fast. And that the reinventing the notion of what cities and towns are about and how you overcome the complexities of different forms of movement, you know, that's a very energetic and, you know, a country which pulls together all sorts of resources. Look at this, you know, CNU right. in Buffalo, you see a lot of interesting, intelligent people putting their minds to this. And so if the lessons that people like Hans Mondermann and Joost Waal have taught us from Europe can contribute to reconciling traffic movement with cities, then that's just one component of a really important regeneration of urbanity, which can encourage, well, ultimately this is about, which is civility, the yeah. notion of civil life. And civility is an interesting notion that has not yet appeared in engineering manuals. We can't measure it, but everybody recognizes it.
Right, right. I am so excited to hear your plenary on Friday. And thank you for being on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Ben Hamilton Bailey.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so
much. Very kind.
Take care, everybody, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town.
They know that America's one big pothole right now.
Chuck Marone, this has been fascinating.
The United Nations Earth Summit. Agenda 21. Yeah.
We studied traffic patterns and found that drivers move the fastest through yellow lights. So now, we just have the red and yellow lights. Yay.
Come on, stay yellow, stay yellow! Man, I'm making record time.
If only I had someplace to be.